Norm's Conceptual Corner.
Well, we're off to a raging start. Good morning, good afternoon, or good night to anyone who's listening. This is Norm Schultz, another episode of Norm's Conceptual Corner. I'm joined by the usual suspects here in the studio with me. Studio, that's what we're calling it now. It's Brittany Rose now.
Morning.
Nick and Chalmer have been cracking us up. So, yes, Nick Arcus, good morning or whatever.
Well, good morning. I'm in the remote war room.
Yeah. And Chalmer Wren.
Good morning.
Excellent. Excellent. So this is the second episode in our Philosophy of Religion series. Our plan is to talk a little bit about what's this God that we're all speaking of, and then talk about a odd argument called the ontological argument, which also is going to tell us a little bit about God. But just to get things started, obviously people have different conceptions of God, right? So we've got some items here that this is a little bit of a review. We've got some items, though, that relate to different conceptions of God or different religious conceptions. Obviously, the perspective we're coming from, gradually, we're going to show that we're all atheists. Big surprise. I think some people start off as an agnostic. By the way, can anybody here relate to being an agnostic at some point, calling yourself an agnostic?
I was.
Yeah, I definitely did.
Yeah. Briefly.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I did until you had me read a paper because you told me I'm not really an agnostic. I just don't know what I'm talking about. And you were right. It was really just a definitional thing. I didn't understand, I suppose, what an agnostic was. I didn't understand. I think, isn't it like an agnostic person thinks there's not enough evidence to make a decision one way or the other?
Yeah.
And I really wasn't in the middle exactly like that. And I wasn't, I wasn't agnostic about the idea of whether it was possible or not. So it just wasn't proper to call myself that. Really, it was just I didn't know that there was such a thing as positive or negative atheism.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about this in more detail in another episode, but just real briefly. You know, if you're an agnostic, yeah, you're really saying, boy, I really don't know enough to call it on that one. And, yeah, it could go either way. So I think there are probably legitimate arguments on both sides, and I just don't have enough to make up my mind. That's really the agnostic position. And I think most people who are agnostics for two reasons. One, they really don't understand how argument works. And two, they don't want to offend people. So saying agnostic, it seems less offensive than saying you're an atheist.
Yeah, I know. I was an agnostic because I have a lot of religious family. And so for me, it was a nice way to walk that line.
Right.
Without pissing anyone off.
Right.
It's still an A word, but it's not as terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it has the word Gnostic in there, for God's sake.
Yeah. But, it's just funny, though, that people are not agnostic on lots of things where technically the data is insufficient. So, you know, none of us here has been to the Scottish Loch to see if there's a monster there. But I don't think we are truly agnostic about the Loch Ness Monster. I think we're pretty much believing that it's bullshit.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's like Loch with less monsters in it, though.
I just believe in one less monster than you do.
It's a sad truth, actually. I always wanted that Loch Ness Monster to be real.
That would be cool.
Would be.
Yeah, but, you know, and so if you think about it, well, okay, what's the difference? We haven't gone there and done our own investigation. I don't, maybe Chalmer has, but I don't think anybody else here has read a lot about the Loch. And the kinds of stuff that they've done to try to find. I've read a little bit, but, you know.
Minimal.
I've read quite a lot.
I bet you have.
So, I've seen a lot of documentaries on it.
Really? Okay. So, you know, so that's a good frame of reference. We don't tend to fall right on the middle on most things. We tend to fall in one direction or the other. But people like to pretend that they're right in the middle when it comes to God. And again, that's mostly to avoid offending people.
Now, the problem is that when I was younger, I was a lot more Agent Mulder, where I really wanted to believe. But now I've become a lot more Dana Scully.
Gotcha.
Just not, you know, not as attractive as she was. But
not nearly as attractive.
I do my best.
So
tender care today.
So, you know, just to go down some of these things, again, this is a little bit of a review, but, you know, there's dynamism, which is the belief in a kind of a force of energy, or that there's some place that has energy. This would be a weird idea. It almost sounds like Lord of the Rings-ish.
Like Gaia?
Kind of.
Okay.
Or some people have a version of this who call themselves naturists. They believe that when you get out in nature that you get God's energy somehow. And we're not going to talk about beliefs like that because that's so abstract that it's not a good place to start. Retriism, the belief that the gods or God used to exist and then died. We're not going to really talk about that because I think is a pretty standard argument against that. What does the universe look like where God made it and died compared to the universe that there was never a God to begin with? I think they look identical. So, you know, that's the problem. Polytheism, belief in many gods. I'm sure that there are some New Agers out there in the Western world that are polytheists. As far as...
Well, thank you.
Huh?
Quite a few, actually.
Yeah, I can think probably for the cool factor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as the major religions, you could say Hinduism is polytheistic, but I think arguments can be made that they're not, that they're really just manifestations of a conflict and that there really is just one. But I think that there's a lot of variety there. But regardless, it doesn't make sense to talk about beliefs in many gods first. It seems to make sense to talk in belief in one first and then address many later.
Yeah.
So, pantheism, which is the idea that it's not that there are many gods, it's that everything is God.
Yeah, which is what I would call Hinduism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is that that's not a good place to start either, because that's kind of – I have this problem with replacing words with other words. We already have a word for everything. It's called everything. Or we could say the universe. And if that's just what you decide to call God, then I don't know what we're doing anymore. You know,
it seems like that's kind of cheating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, okay, we've got different sounds that we're using to denote the same thing, but in actuality, it's not the same thing. You think that the universe is a being of some sort with intention and things like that, and I don't. And so, as it turns out, a lot of the arguments for and against the existence of the traditional God address the idea of intention in the universe. So it's kind of a way, a stepping stone to talking about pantheism anyway. Does that make sense?
And I think pantheism is a lot of like, it's that spiritual but not religious. It's almost like being agnostic. They do it so that they can still talk about a God and not offend people, but not really commit to monotheism or something.
I think it also... is partially motivated by beautifying your look on the world, that it just seems somehow aesthetically satisfying to view that the universe itself is one big being and therefore we're in its care. And that can be such an abstract claim that it's really difficult to address.
It's nice.
So, and, you know, to someone who believes that, I would exactly approach it from the perspective of spiritual, not religious. And I would ask them, well, okay, so if that's true, why do you need to go somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
You don't, God is already there. So you don't need to go to any church. You don't need to bow down or anything like that. God already knows. I mean, you're part of him. So how does your behavior differ from that of an atheist? I don't know that it really necessarily will. Mm-mm. So... basically, the reason why, and this is the summary that I'm getting at, the reason why philosophy of religion starts with the Judeo-Christian God is because it's the clearest conception of God that's logical to start with. And along the way, you end up addressing a lot of spiritual beliefs that are related to these other conceptions of God anyway. So I think it's a legitimate place to start, as well as it's the most popular version of God. I mean, most people, since it includes Jews, Christians, and Muslims, most people believe in this version of God. So for those reasons, I think it's legit to start with this. It's not Western-centric or things like that. It's just a good place to start. Make sense, everybody?
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, then let's talk about what is this being that we're referring to. I think we talked about this briefly before in a previous episode, but not the first episode in this series. So as far as, you know, the Judeo-Christian God, obviously that God is the creator, creator of the world or the universe. I personally think that it's fine for a person who is a believer to take the Genesis story as being not necessarily accurate. I think it's legitimate to say that that is a story intending to make a point. It's not really a story that is intending to be methodical. So when you say that God created the universe and you got all these details about him, you know, separating the night and the day and things like that, if I believed in God, I would not worry about those details. I would just say, well, God created the universe by some method. It probably looked like the Big Bang. And I think that that's fine. Does that seem legit to you guys?
Yeah, yeah. You got to start somewhere. So yeah.
Yeah. So whatever the word creator means, I think that it's fair to give Christians leeway on that. I don't think we need to hold them to just the Genesis account strictly. We can talk about that more later, but God is supposed to be omnipotent. That's all powerful. This criteria turns out to be a bit of a puzzle. Because what does it mean for God to be omnipotent? I think there is a good traditional philosophical argument about this, which is the paradox of the stone. Can God make a stone so big that even he can't lift it?
Or my favorite is from The Simpsons. Can God microwave a burrito so hot even he can't eat it?
Right.
Yep. What does God need with a starship?
What?
I said, why does God need a starship?
Yeah, yeah. I think that omnipotence is a weird property. When you say all-powerful, it is an interesting question of what would that look like?
Capable of all potential.
Right. And so, yeah, I think that an intelligent Christian is going to go the route that Chalmer just said, which is that omnipotent means God can do everything that's possible, because if it's impossible, then it's impossible. If God can do it, then it's not impossible. So what are we talking about? Saying God can do the impossible is a stupid thing to say.
Yeah.
Because that makes it possible. And so, you know, if you can talk about square circles and things like that, can God make a square circle? No, because a square circle is impossible. And this is not a problem for your theistic beliefs or religion. Don't freak out. I think that that works out just fine. So, you know, we'll talk about that a little more in a future episode, because there is a problem related to that. But we can just skip over that for now. Okay, so God is omnipotent. God is omniscient. God knows everything. This also creates a problem with respect to the future. Basically, all of us here are science fiction kind of geeks. So we know that the idea of time travel creates certain paradoxes.
Yeah. And
so if God knows the future, then that's kind of a form of time travel. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. This creates certain paradoxes, right? So, you know, if God knows the future and sees something he doesn't like, and then gets you to do something different, well, then, and that changes the future, well, then what he knew earlier, wasn't that wrong? And God's supposed to never be wrong.
And does he know the new future?
Right.
He knows all possible futures.
Ah.
So that would be an infinite number of futures. And, yeah. You know, sure, if he's God, okay, he can know an infinite number of things. But that brings up problems, too.
Yeah.
Because if you know something... You know, the concept of a real infinity we're going to talk about later.
You'd just be paralyzed by indecision.
That would be bizarre.
Yeah.
But it also brings up a problem relating to human free will. If God knows what you're going to do in advance, how in the world is it possible that you're actually choosing it?
And why is it that you need to prove everything?
What do you mean?
Oh, I don't know if it was every Christian sect, for a lack of a better word. But my my high school, remember, I went to that Baptist school, and they always were saying you need to prove to God. You need to prove.
Oh, right.
So why, if he already knows, then what am I proving?
Now I got it.
And that's kind of one of the things that's always been in my head of, well, if he already knows, then can't I just go eat a sandwich? Like, can we move on now?
Yeah. And, you know, I would say that the Matrix movies get into this a bit, where, you know, the future is set, but so what choice do you have? Well, it's to accept what you're going to do. And I think that that's probably a cheap way out, actually. It mm-hmm. sounded cool in the movie, but it doesn't, I don't think it actually makes much sense.
Yeah.
I prefer Terminator 2. No fate but what we make.
But yeah. There are more guns.
So, you know, as far as the free will problem, I think that really is a problem. And I think we can choose a time to talk about it later. But for now, let's just regard that, you know, God knows everything. And we're not exactly sure what that means relating to the future of free will. But, you know, and the maximum possible there is to know, well, that's where God is. Other things. God is supposed to be eternal, as in, you know, he never had a beginning, will never have an end. And God is the judge of the world. That if you don't believe in that last part, then you're kind of a deist. A deist being someone who believes that God exists, made the world, but he has no bearing or attention on what human beings are doing. He just set things in motion and then went off to do other things. And, you know, I think there have been some famous deists. I think some of the founding fathers were deists. And I think a deist acts and walks and talks like an atheist. So I don't know that we need to make a big distinction with that. But, you know, it is important to consider that part of the definition of this God is that he's taking an active role in paying attention to what human beings are doing, paying attention to, oh, you know, what you are doing, you know, who
what
you are
eating.
Yes, who you are associating with, what parts of your body you're touching, etc.
How often what you bathe. Thinking?
Right. So, and that seems, that brings up some problems. You know, I think there's a sense of, why would God be interested in this?
Yeah.
If I created the universe, considering how freaking amazingly huge it is, why would you care what this tiny, minuscule being is doing at this moment? So, but regardless, that's part of the idea of God. I think you could probably bring up some other attributes, but I think they're kind of secondary. Does anybody else want to talk about anything to frame God a little closer here?
Well, that omnibenevolent, that was a new one on me.
Oh, right.
That wasn't, I guess it makes sense as far as, you know, my limited interactions with Christians. But
God is good.
I hear omnibenevolence a lot.
Yeah, I think it was because I had a very, you know, limited 3 years isn't a long time to get really deep into it. But that was interesting, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you don't include the concept that God is good in your definition of what God you're talking about, then, you know, you run into what
Cthulhu.
I'll call the constants. Not constants. The, what am I thinking? Wow, the other Keanu Reeves movie. Constantine? Yeah. You go the Constantine route. God's a kid with an ant farm.
Yeah, I just watched that.
Really?
So did I.
Yeah, so
Netflix.
Did I.
Yeah, me too.
That's hilarious.
That's funny.
So, and that's, you know, if someone were to believe that, then I would say, okay, so you're just going to church out of pure fear. There's no love or any of this traditional Christian stuff in there.
It's a traditional Catholic right there.
Yeah, I always thought it was funny that movie used that reference, because a friend of mine used to say that he always looked at the idea of if there was a God, that he was just like a kid with an ant farm.
Sure.
And he doesn't care what his ants do or how many of them he has. He just wants to have ants.
Right. Or, you know, a kid with an ant farm and a magnifying glass.
We gotta have some fun.
Right. So, I think that route doesn't lead you to religiosity. Any form of legitimate religiosity, I don't think. And I imagine that there's a side of fear that makes people go to church, but that, you know, you're still believing that this being exists. And so that's why I like to focus on that. I think we can talk about whether God is benevolent or not later when we talk about the problem of evil. But look, all those three major religions believe that God is good, and if we think they're not, then we're the ones who are mistaken. So we can just set that one aside for now. So, okay. Are we pretty good on all that?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
so.
All right. Well, so now I want to talk. When I would do this in my class, I kind of have them wipe their minds. Like, okay, forget all of the stuff that we just talked about for now.
Mm. Done.
Pretend. That was
you
too easy.
You must unlearn what you have learned.
Who are you guys?
What is this thing in front of me?
Where am I?
What I want to talk about is superheroes. I want to talk about
about goddamn time.
I want to talk about your favorite superhero as well as superhero powers. Okay. And I'm dead serious. And my students, you know, when they look at me like, you know, we're in a college classroom and we're going to have the geeky conversation about superheroes, they at first look confused and look around, and then they start to get a little excited, like, wow, we're actually going to do this. No, seriously, we're happening. Actually going to do this. So
experience many times.
Yeah. So, okay. No lie. Around the room, or metaphorically. Who's your favorite superhero and why? Who wants to start? I'm going to say Chalmer.
I'll start. So I grew up reading Spider-Man comics.
Okay.
So I'm going to say Spider-Man because that's nostalgic.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So because it reminds you of your youth.
Yeah. So I had a whole bunch of Spider-Man comics when I was a kid.
I gotcha.
So that I just remember that being my favorite character.
I gotcha. So you're choosing him as your favorite, not because of power level or anything, but just because of more relating to you than the character.
Yeah.
I got it. So you admit that Spider-Man, as far as compared to other superheroes, is not really all that powerful.
No, not yeah.
Yeah.
He can't do a whole lot.
He's fast, and he's got the Spidey sense, which helps him out a lot.
He can shoot that stuff.
Is he strong? Listen up. He's got radioactive blood.
Wow.
Spider-Man is my favorite comic book hero.
Really?
Really?
So for Spidey.
Wow.
Well, when I was, you know, I'm a big Joseph Campbell fan, and so I like the idea of a hero's journey, and I identify with his a lot. I like that he's a young superhero, so that's different from a lot of other ones. I like that he's somewhat of an outsider or an outcast, and I identify strongly with feeling that he was kind of a dorky kid who didn't, you know, wasn't good at getting dates. He wasn't good at relating with people. He wasn't a jock. I like that he's sarcastic, though, and I like the. It's cliche now, but I really do like that lesson he learned from Uncle Ben. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. I think that's his. One of his most defining attributes, and yeah, I really like Spider-Man a lot. He's not the most—he's not the strongest superhero, and his, you know, scope is limited only to New York. But he's my favorite.
Yeah,
yeah.
Interesting.
Wow.
Huh. So this is also you're choosing him again, not because of power level, but because of personal attachment to him.
Okay.
Yeah, I identify more with his hero's journey.
I like the narrative of Spider-Man.
I gotcha. I must admit I didn't. I like the concept of comic books, but I was not allowed to have them when I was a kid because of being pretty highly religious, and my religion was pretty restrictive. And so, you know, because of the weird elements and occult elements that were found in commonly in comic books were not at all popular amongst Jehovah's Witnesses.
That makes sense.
I imagine.
Also because of strictly time. I mean, between school and going to church and, you know, doing stuff around the house, you really don't have a whole lot of time to be going out and buying and reading comic books. So I don't know any Jehovah's Witness kids who are big on comic books. There might be some exceptions because there's different kind of culture areas.
Mm-hmm.
If I had grown up in a different part of the United States, maybe that would have been more accepted.
Or a less devout family.
Sure. Oddly enough, I did watch TV shows based on superheroes, and we all did. And, you know, I had a big crush on Wonder Woman.
Oh, yeah.
So
who didn't, really?
I'm a big fan of Wonder Woman. She's not my favorite superhero, though. I always thought that Superman was kind of an asshole. So I recognize his power level, but I'm not a big fan of Superman.
Hmm.
No.
And I like Batman, but he doesn't have any actual powers. So I don't really care for him as a superhero either.
You could argue in the DC universe that he has like super intellect.
Can we use super villains? Because those, my favorite is actually kind of a bad guy.
Sure.
Ooh, nice.
Azrael, Nightcrawler's father.
Oh,
yeah.
Fucking Red Devil. He's my absolute favorite.
I'm not familiar with him. Tell me about him.
So he's Nightcrawler's father. Okay. He slept with Mystique to create Nightcrawler.
Oh, okay.
And he has.
This is X-Men.
This is X-Men. This is the X-Men universe. And he has transdimensional teleportation.
How do you spell his name?
I'm going to Google
it. You can do look up Red Devil or Nightcrawler's dad.
Okay.
Or not.
They did a version of him in the movie X-Men First Class.
Did they?
Yeah, they had a version of him.
There you go. There you go.
He had a very, very nice goatee.
Azrael, okay. Cool.
So, he's not a good guy, but just his powers and what he's able to do is really cool. He can just, on the, think about it and be in another dimension, in another universe. He can go to different planets throughout the universe. It's just, because you know, Nightcrawler is limited.
Right.
He has to see where he's going. And he doesn't have the same limitations.
Oh, it's Azazel.
Azazel.
Oh, yeah. This is the same Azazel that was mentioned in that... what is that... the movie with Denzel Washington?
Deja Vu?
No.
Oh, are you talking
Fallen?
About...
Fallen. Yep.
Fallen?
Yeah.
Yep. It's a creepy movie.
Azazel is a fallen angel, so a demon, basically,
who's
on Earth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
X-Men takes that
There's
and makes
crossover,
it...
There's
some
crossover, yeah.
Yeah. I don't,
yeah, in the movie Fallen, he jumps by touch.
Huh.
Huh. Yeah, so he's super cool, and he's just an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just
So he's a teleporter. So, mm-hmm. Just as far as for my thinking, his weakness would be if you catch him before he can teleport, then he's just a human or a being. You can kill him, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that he might have... It'd be really hard to catch him, but yeah.
Yeah.
You could kill him, but he has fights with the X-Men, and he's pretty resilient, hard to catch, hard to hit guy.
I think... So in Days of Future Past, he was... And he was killed. He wasn't killed in the movie, but it showed that he was subject to testing and was dead.
Was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, he's got some weaknesses, but yeah, those are the teleporters are cool characters.
Yeah, and no, he doesn't have laser eyes or
right
anything like that.
I think
I also have to say Wolverine is a close second for me.
I was torn between him and Wolverine.
Wolverine is very popular.
Yeah.
I love Wolverine.
And the fact that he can live essentially forever.
You guys are very different than me on this issue.
Yeah.
What's fun about Wolverine is he didn't actually originate in an X-Men comic. He actually came from the Hulk.
Yeah.
It was the Hulk versus the Wolverine from Canada.
We're getting Wolverine religious over here.
We are. And Queen. Mm-hmm. We've got to mix it up.
I see. Yeah,
I like the narrative of mortality that that character has the potential to tell.
I think
the idea that he exists for a long period of time and it goes in and out of people's lives, sort of a transient character.
What's really funny is I'm listening to all this, I'm associating this to how each of you would play Magic the Gathering.
I would keep looking at your cards.
And it really is telling that I played control decks. My objective when I played, for most of the time, not all the time, I used to try different things, but most of the time my objective was to slowly establish an inevitability that you could not do anything to get out of, and you were completely frustrated, and then I would just gradually run you over.
So, Juggernaut.
Not really a Juggernaut.
You sound more like Varen von Doom.
Not really a Juggernaut, because a Juggernaut goes the same speed, right? It's just... The inevitability part, but the Juggernaut is not trying to control things. It's just kind of trying to break through.
Yeah.
I'm wanting to establish absolute control over everything and then, you know, take care of business after that.
Hmm. You're Thanos.
Ooh. Got it.
Well, yeah. So look, my favorite superhero is Dr. Manhattan.
Ooh.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
Because, he doesn't have the weaknesses of these characters, and that's the reason why I like him.
Yeah.
He really doesn't have any weaknesses.
No, he's basically a god.
You could say that his emotions in the beginning were his weakness.
In fact, if you look him up,
his greatest strength.
Yes. So I'm serious. If you look him up, will find that his only weakness is mental, his mental state. That under John Osterman, which is the listing in DC Wiki, you can do this with any superhero. You can look at their powers and attributes and their weaknesses. Yeah.
Google.
And there's like maybe only two or three websites that actually collect all this information. It depends on what universe they're in. Mm-hmm. But if you look him up, it talks about him being able to manipulate time, physics at the most basic level. He has unlimited strength. He can teleport. And he just, you know, has all of these. He's a master over, you know, the matter in general, and that includes being a master of time. And yeah, the only weaknesses are himself. He gets depressed from seeing things in a different perspective. You know, in the Watchmen movie and book, he starts to actually lose interest in human things.
Not only that, it's telling that in the movie and book, the person who is able to, quote, defeat him, at least for a time, is Ozymandias, who is the smartest man or being in the planet. That's his power, is being the smartest person.
Right.
And so he outthinks Dr. Manhattan. He creates a situation through a series of events over years, not only to make him depressed, but he also pours money into researching, I think, in the universe, it's tachyons, and that clouds Dr. Manhattan's vision in the future.
Right.
There's one time.
Because tachyon particles, it's funny, it's based on pseudoscience. Those are particles that they believe can go forward and backward through time if they exist.
Yeah. But, you know.
He gets depressed and goes sits on a moon.
Sure.
On Mars. Was it Mars? And he just sits there.
Yeah.
And he's so sad.
He doesn't sit there. He builds a gigantic.
Yeah, he's thinking. He's thinking of what to do.
He suffers from apathy.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a real problem that the philosophers have talked about. If you really had no needs, you know, desires are things that you need. If you have no needs, then what reason is there to do anything?
Yeah.
And by the way, this is a criticism.
Where does motivation come from?
Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, where does
God's motivation come from? Why is he
Well, let's not talk about God yet. We're almost there. Okay. We're still talking about superheroes. I almost did it too. Yeah, I understand. I almost did it too. But I think this is covered actually surprisingly in the movie Ex Machina.
You know, I never saw it.
Okay. I never saw it yet either. I really want to. It's quite good.
It's a great movie.
Okay, so seriously, you, Brittany, and Nick need to see Ex Machina.
Okay.
If you guys are into sci-fi and all that, you need to see it.
Okay.
So Chalmer, you remember in the movie, he talks about why he gives the AI sexual desire. And it's because he was worried about it not having motivation to do anything if it didn't have any desires. Yeah.
Exactly.
I thought that was a really good reference to some philosophy.
It's funny that he gave a machine a desire that's so easily laced with violence.
Sure.
I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know if she goes crazy. But it's kind of funny that, you know, every species on the planet, their sexual desires are usually laced with violence. It's funny.
There's a couple movies that talk about that relationship too.
But Sorry, that was my side.
Absolutely. But
have you ever seen Dark City?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't really care for it actually.
Oh, I love Dark City.
I like Dark City a lot.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies ever.
Well, maybe I should watch it again.
I love the visuals.
But look, okay, so we talked about superheroes. We talked about characters we like. I think let me just kind of talk, and I want you guys to interject your thoughts, but let me just kind of talk about how this goes. So we're not going to claim that Spider-Man is, you know, a high level of superhero. And I think there's some tradition in the superhero universe to rate the power level of superheroes.
There is, yeah.
I don't know the rating system offhand. I know that it exists, but I don't think Spider-Man is very high up there. Mm-mm. I think Superman is rated pretty high, but of course we know his weakness is kryptonite.
Mm-hmm. And being an ass.
Well.
He goes bad a lot.
Yeah.
Superman's kryptonite is kryptonite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, and so, you know, when is the Batman Superman movie coming out?
Later this year?
Is it March?
To me.
March or May?
I mean, I think that movie, we'll see how it works out. It might be cool to watch, but to me, they might as well call that movie Batman's Search for Kryptonite. Because if he doesn't find kryptonite, he's fucked.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what else gadgets he has. Those would be temporary things to inhibit Superman. If you don't have kryptonite, then forget it. Mm-hmm. Superman's powers are going to trump what you can do.
Yeah.
So, you know, Superman is super powerful, but he has one inherent weakness. And I'm sure that's probably why they gave him one weakness, mm-hmm. is to make things interesting.
He's an interesting character because he didn't start off super powered like that. It's just gradually increased over the years.
So if he goes into a solar system that doesn't have the sun, then he won't have his powers. He'll become a normal human. He gets his powers from the essentially UV rays of the sun.
So when he goes down into the Earth to move a plate to recover from the earthquake in one of the movies, was that just an error?
I think that maybe he has stored up power and it takes him a while to lose his power, just like with the kryptonite.
That seems to be how they use it.
Yeah, it takes a minute for the kryptonite to fully affect him. And so I'm wondering if maybe he just, it's a, kind of an inertia type thing.
I gotcha.
Because he's able to operate at night.
Yeah, he's able to operate, and he's able to operate on different planets that are maybe farther away at the same level of power.
Got it. I'm taking notes. So to beat Superman, option one, kryptonite. Option two, destroy the sun.
Or remove him from...
Well, that's not going to work.
If you're Azazel, it does.
Pardon me?
If you have the transportation or the teleportation.
So you just teleport him somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, you have... I stand corrected. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, just teleport
this,
him.
This, by the way, I want to register this. This is one of the other weaknesses of Superman. He is tied to place and time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. No, he did go back in time that one time. Well... to save Lois Lane. He turned the...
But that's a slow, gradual...
That was stupid, though.
Yeah. But he still had to do it, though.
He did.
He can't just transport in time. He has to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. And this is, by the way, my problem with Wolverine. I like the Wolverine character a lot. Mm-hmm. I think he's awesome. And, yeah, I like the fact that he's basically immortal. That's really cool. But, you know, he's a scrapper.
Yeah.
He has no distance ability. And so if you want to get him out of the picture, just move him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and not only that, I mean, he's made of metal, so he can't come anywhere near Magneto.
Right. He's fucked.
Yeah.
This is one of the weaknesses of the Hulk. The Hulk is regarded as a very high-level, powerful superhero because he's basically
unlimited strength.
Yeah. Basically unlimited strength and basically indestructible. I think there was some comic book that mentioned that there was just like something was done to him where there was only one cell left and he just regrew from that cell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, he's super high level power. But if you want him out of the picture, just send him away.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he's got no means of.
They've shot him into space so many times.
Exactly.
It is. Yeah.
They just get rid of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, during the Marvel Civil War, both sides wanted him out of the way because whoever had him on their side would win.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's tied to place and time as well, and that's a limitation, a weakness of him.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Dr. Manhattan doesn't have this issue. Mm-hmm. It's extremely difficult to remove him, even for about a minute, which is what Ozymandias did. You know, it's kind of weird that scene. It makes it for an interesting story, but I think it's kind of funny to have this part of the story where Ozymandias spends a huge amount of research and money to develop a device to basically move Dr. Manhattan out of the way for 1 minute.
Well, what's funny is he thought that it would last potentially for longer, but he really just needed a minute to show him his TV screens.
Right. Weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. Yes. So, you know, when you get to a level of a superhero like Dr. Manhattan, then yes, what you did earlier, Chalmer, is what our instinct is. At that point, at that power level, they're kind of like a god.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And where this is going is that if you think about all the properties and all the traits of a superhero, if you wanted to take any of those traits and just imagine them on a volume scale and turn them to 10.
11 is
loud. 11. Yeah, turn them to 11. In other words, turn them to the absolute maximum they could be. If you did that, eventually you would end up at God.
Mm-hmm.
And... That's where I want to make sure everybody understands. I'm sure everybody here does. That any superhero trait that you can think of, God has the best version of that trait to the highest possible degree. Right? So imagine any distance weapon, you know, in any of the X-Men universe, you know, plasma fields, fire, whatever you want. God has that because wherever you're targeting, well, he can just do whatever you're talking about, your beam is doing. He can just do that.
Mm-hmm. Or do the opposite of it and negate it.
Right. So he's got the maximum distance weapons, and it doesn't matter how far it is. He does it instantaneously. So he's also not restricted to space and time, so you can't send him away to get him out of the picture. That's not possible. You also can't send him in time because he's everywhere in time. Mm-hmm. He's of infinite strength, so it's not like you can punch him.
Really, he's a maxed out RPG character.
Sure.
Yeah, he's no celestial. No, he's solar level of all of his traits.
Sure.
That's essentially what it is.
Sure.
With maximum refresh.
Right. you know, I mean, add anything else. Anybody want to add anything?
I don't know what we can add.
Well, the only everything. Thing that I could see would be his weakness would be apathy.
And this is the same weakness as Dr. Manhattan.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that's why the Christian tradition adds that he is all good and he's paying attention to what we're doing. So
he throwing love into that.
Right. Why he does that? Well, then they get the get out of jail free card of we don't understand his mind because we can't. And on that issue, I'm okay with, because if we don't understand what his motivations are for paying attention to us, mm-hmm. I'm okay with thinking that, well, maybe that would be difficult for me to understand. And because, you know, I would relate that to the relationship of a parent to a child. If a child asked, why do you care about me, to their parent, mm-hmm. I think the parent's explanation the child probably wouldn't get. So I have no problem with that as far as the Christian tradition of that version of getting out of it.
Okay.
Regardless, I think it's really interesting that God, this concept of God, is a concept of the maximum possible being you can imagine.
Right.
So this gets us right into the ontological argument, because here's the simplest way. This argument, began with Anselm. I'm sorry. I'm terrible with dates. I'm a bad philosopher. I don't remember when Anselm lived. It was, I think, the 7th century or something like
probably
that.
Probably back in November.
A while ago. But regardless, the way he wrote the argument, if you were to read him, it's worded weird because of the time.
It is.
So long story short, you can state the argument in a much more efficient way than it was stated before. we already agreed that the concept of God is the maximum possible being. Take every trait that you can think of and just turn it up to the absolute top and you have God. And so God being the maximum being that you can imagine, well, now you have a problem, because you can imagine two versions of that. One version is a God that has all those traits and doesn't exist. And another is a God who has all those traits and exists. The problem is we already said that God is have a maximum of all the traits. Well, existence is a trait, and the maximum of that is to exist. So we just proved that God exists. Because everybody here agreed that God is the version of a being with all of the traits maxed out. Mm-hmm. So you guys already
just did a magic trick.
You guys already believe. Yeah. You guys already believe that God exists.
He brought us in with superheroes and
yeah.
Norm, you know, I told this to Chalmer earlier. Like, whenever people roll their eyes at philosophy and scoff, this is why.
Yeah.
This kind of argument.
You just pulled a rabbit out of the hat.
First, you created the hat, and then you did it.
Let's do this from a different angle, though. So I know this might seem silly, but does everybody have a piece of paper near them? You've got them backside. You guys got a piece of paper or something that you can write on?
Yeah.
Nick?
Yep.
So here's what I want you to do. I want you to make 4 quadrants on the piece of paper. So just draw a straight line in the middle and a straight line across the right of one vertical, one horizontal.
Okay.
And at the top, you're going to label the columns. At the top left, you're going to call this stuff that exists.
Got it.
And then the right column, you're going to say stuff that doesn't exist.
Okay.
Okay. So now we're going to start talking about stuff. So stuff that exists. Let's just throw some stuff in this top left box.
Chairs.
Coffee.
Me.
Okay. Chalmer.
Chalmer.
Nick, throw one in.
Computers.
Computers.
All these are C words.
All right. All these are C words, yeah. Okay, now, on the right, and before you put them in the top right or bottom right column, say what it is you're thinking of as far as it doesn't exist, because we're going to see a distinction here. So let's just brainstorm. What is some stuff that doesn't exist? So dragons. Again, don't write it in yet. Oh. What is it?
Dragons.
Dragons?
Yes.
Okay, put that in the top right. Dragons. Okay. Nick.
Leprechauns.
Okay. Well, what is a leprechaun?
It's a little tiny person who usually has a pot of gold he's concerned with.
Are there any powers or anything involved in leprechauns?
I think they're magic, but I'm not quite sure what the extent of his magic is, actually.
Something about rainbows and granting wishes, I think.
What is magic?
The gathering, or?
No. I'm dead serious. What do you mean by magic?
Magic would seem to be the ability to, I don't know, violate the laws of, quote, nature.
Violate the laws of nature.
Or go around them, right?
Well, okay, so...
Or suspend them or disregard them.
We're going to put leprechauns in the bottom right.
Because leprechauns are magic.
Chalmer, you got anything?
Magic.
Okay. We're going to put magic in the bottom right with a question mark next to it.
Or
cold fusion.
Cold fusion we're going to put in the top right.
Okay.
Yeah. Perpetual motion.
Perpetual motion we're going to put in the bottom right.
What about things that don't exist yet, like quantum computers?
We're going to put that in the top right. And just to see if you guys can figure out what the difference is between these, I'm going to say two. Yeah. One, the top right, I'm going to say unicorn. And the bottom right, I'm going to say the largest number.
Are we talking about things that could exist versus things that could not exist, whether they exist or not?
You got it. Okay?
Yeah.
So we have, on the left, stuff that exists, all the stuff that we're familiar with. On the right, we've got a column that is broken into two areas. Stuff that doesn't exist, but it doesn't exist for two reasons. Dragons, cold fusion, quantum computers, and unicorns, they don't exist, but they're not impossible. There is nothing that violates the rules of nature to have a horse that has a horn in the center. There's nothing that violates the rules of nature to have a computer that is based on quantum changes. We're probably going to have that. I'm not going to say that cold fusion is impossible. Seems to me as long as there's some sort of energy source, you should be able to convert things. But I don't know enough about it to call it, but I think that that's probably not impossible. Dragons are not impossible. There are flying animals. There are animals that can make hot, material. So whatever. Leprechauns, if they have the ability to use magic, well, then that might drift into not being possible. Magic itself might not be possible because it might be a contradiction of what's possible. It's a concept that is a contradiction. Mm-hmm. Perpetual motion is not possible because of the laws of energy. And the largest number is not possible because that's not how numbers work.
Yeah.
Everybody cool so far?
Yeah.
Yep.
Notice that we have a gaping hole here. We have a box that has nothing in it.
Yep.
The lower left.
Okay. So here's how this works. The top area are contingent things. These are things that exist or don't exist, but they could or couldn't. It doesn't make any difference. They're possible, but it doesn't make any difference.
So do you mean like they're contingent on the right circumstances?
Right. So, the reason why there are chairs is because there are human beings who evolved a certain way. There could easily be not chairs. We can imagine a universe working that doesn't have chairs. Mm-hmm. We can imagine a universe working without coffee, though I don't want to. I can certainly and sometimes would like to imagine a universe without Chalmer.
Oh, Chalmer.
When Chalmer irritates me when he doesn't get my email or something, and I'm like, God damn it, Chalmer.
Oh, it's Chalmer.
Too soon? Too soon, Chalmer?
Too soon.
Okay. it's all out of love. Anyway, I can certainly imagine a universe without computers. So no problem. I can imagine a universe with dragons or cold fusion or quantum computers and unicorns, right? We cannot imagine a universe with a largest number. That makes no sense. We cannot imagine a universe with a perpetual motion machine. That makes no sense. And same thing for magic in a certain conception. So this bottom area, the top area is contingent things. The bottom area is necessary things. So you can just put that on the left side with the rows. The top left side is contingent. And the bottom is necessary. So the ontological argument basically says that this bottom left box that we have nothing in, well, there needs to be something in that. And that would be God. So just write God in there, because God is something that must exist. It's not possible for God to not exist because of the conception of God. And there has to be something in this box in order for this chart to make sense. That's another version of this argument. Kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay? And so God is a necessary being because his conception includes his existence. You cannot imagine a being that has all of the traits of a maximum being that doesn't exist, because then that would be a being that lacks one of the those traits, existence. So we know God exists by just thinking about him. What do you guys got?
It seems like a magic trick. I like the way Chalmer put that.
Seems like a magic trick is not an argument.
Well, just because you're thinking about something does not necessarily mean it exists.
Well, of course.
So I don't see how it makes it necessary just because we think of a being with all these traits. We think of Thor and we think of all these superheroes doesn't mean they actually exist.
Yeah, they don't have their existence built into the concept. Us thinking about God is not what makes him exist. It's the concept of God what makes him exist.
But wouldn't that be circular reasoning, using the thing that you're trying to prove that it exists?
Huh?
You're saying God exists because I thought about God.
No, I'm not. I'm saying God exists because of the conception of God. Whether you think of him or not is irrelevant.
Because God believes in you. If you don't believe in him.
Right. No, not really. No, the conception of God includes necessary existence. So it has nothing to do with whether you know about this or not.
I guess I don't see the connection with why, simply because you can imagine something with maxed out levels, that thing has to also exist.
Yeah, you imagining it, again, is not what matters.
Or it's thinking about it.
You're assuming that he exists in the first place.
I don't get the leap there. Like, I can't connect that dot.
Well, you already, again, it's not about your awareness, but it's about, and by the way, has anybody noticed that I'm
just being difficult?
I'm defending this?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I'm this not is talking about fun. My awareness, though. I mean, like, the concept itself. Because right. Because a concept of something being the best possible thing, I don't see why that, where that entails existence out of it.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, let's get into this as a proper objection. This objection was made by Guinio, a contemporary of Anselm, who basically his argument was, okay, I can imagine the most perfect island, and you know, you can stock it with beautiful women, you can stock it with the most delicious pineapple you've ever had, great music, people who wake you up when they sense that you want to get up in the morning by feathers, whatever. Just make it the most perfect island you could ever experience. Wonderful, perfectly moist, warm breeze coming in over the ocean. No cars. Is this sounding good to everybody?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So you can just imagine this, but that certainly doesn't mean that that island exists. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. Because I'm pretty sure most island vacations involve people coming up to you trying to sell you Chiclets and other annoyances. So this is a version of Guinio's argument. And the reply was that, look, the concept of island doesn't contain anything about its own perfection. So you're just adding to that. That's not built into the concept of an island. And so, of course, that doesn't have to exist. That's not even an argument. God, the concept itself, just means this most perfect being. And that's what everybody knows it to mean. And that includes the perfection of all things. Mm-hmm. So there is no other concept like that. There is no other concept that includes the perfection of all things. By the way, modern philosophy of religion students came up with a different version. They came up with a version of the most perfect pizza.
Ah.
You know, pizza that is perfectly hot. It's got multiple kinds of cheese, calorie free. I don't know.
That'd
whatever.
Be nice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not like this is not talked about in beginning philosophy courses. It certainly is. But the reply is that none of these things that you can come up with contain their own perfection. Really, the only concept that does that is God. And there really can only, forgive the Highlander reference, be only one. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about a being that has all of the perfections of everything. So which would be better, to be a pizza or to be a being with free will? Well, it would be to be a being with free will. So the version of the most perfect pizza would end up being God like everything else.
Yeah, I still just don't see the connection then. Like, I guess I don't understand the conclusion when it comes to this sort of thing. So just because the concept has the, you know, perfection built into it, I still don't see how that gets you to that conclusion of therefore it must exist.
Okay, so you know that 42 is an even number, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, so by agreeing that 42 is an even number, you're agreeing that it's divisible by 2.
Yes.
Right.
That's what an even
That's
number
exactly
is.
What this argument is. By agreeing that God is the conception of maximum of all things, you're already agreeing that he exists. The argument is, there isn't an argument. It's just the way it is.
Huh. It's a trick of language.
Yeah, you could say that. It feels like it's a trick of language more than anything else.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'll tell you what. I'm inclined to leave this unsolved because there are some, I don't know. What do you guys think? Should I do that? I mean, do you want me to solve this or do you want me to just leave this as a project for you guys or others? Maybe we can come back to it later. You want the answer?
Yeah. I want the answer.
Well, there's a couple of different ways of getting out of this. And it really does have to do with conceptualizing what it means for something to exist. I think that Kant got this right, which, by the way, Kant was religious, and he thought the ontological argument was completely full of shit. So I think that probably most people who are religious are not going to be persuaded by this argument. I have met some philosophers who were persuaded by this argument, but, you know, philosophers.
Few and far between.
Trained philosophers believe in the most ridiculous things.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I didn't that didn't bother me. So the first the main gist of Kant's reply to this argument is that existence is not a property. So when you think about God as having the maximum of all properties, when you include existence in there as if it's a property, you have made some sort of category mistake. Category mistake meaning talking about something in a way that doesn't reflect its nature at all. It's not. It doesn't even make any sense. So a category mistake would be like saying, well, the number 30, like the number 30's favorite color is orange.
Number 30 doesn't have a favorite color.
Right, that's ridiculous. That makes no sense. So Kant says that's basically what's going on when you say that existence is a property and God has the maximum of that. Existence is not a property of a thing. And so modern philosophers have given the following analogy, which I found really interesting. Imagine that you were going to a car dealership. And the salesperson was asking you, okay, so what are you looking for? And you're describing what you're looking for in a car. You
want. Is it because you wouldn't say I would like a car that exists?
Well, yeah, you're kind of ruining my mojo here, Nick.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, make another fat joke.
Once again.
So, you know, let's say that you talk about all the traits of the car that you want. You want a car that is blue, metallic. You want a car that is convertible. You want a car that gets good gas mileage and it seats 5 comfortably, has a big trunk, can fit 2 bodies in there, right?
And you don't have to chop them up.
You know, has a lot of power on the highway, is aerodynamic, isn't too noisy when you have the hood closed, etc. Just imagine all that stuff. It would be downright weird if you told the salesperson in there, and I'd prefer it exist.
I prefer.
that the salesperson would listen to all the other things, and when you said that, he would look at you like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, he would look at you the way, because like, ooh, that costs extra.
Yeah.
The car that you can actually sit in.
And vice versa, right? You can
do that. Our standard editions do exist, but...
Right. So vice versa. If you had a salesperson tell you about this great car that has all this stuff and you get excited and he says, and by the way, it actually exists, you would look at him just as equally funny. Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably why we all had that reaction to the God thing. But just because...
Yeah, but I really think that everybody here felt the pull of the fact that this is not an easy argument to get around.
It's not.
You hear it and you recognize that there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And you say that there's something wrong with it, but you really don't come up with an argument against it. Mm-hmm. It's not that easy.
Sounds suspicious.
Yeah. That's not an argument either, right?
Yeah.
No. This sounds fishy.
It sets off your intuition, which you shouldn't really trust always.
Yeah. Okay, it sounds fishy. Well, that's fascinating. Well, the argument still stands. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, you know, when you consider that existence is not actually a property of a thing, I think that that's right. Existence is not a property that a thing has. Existence is a statement of the category of that thing. It's not a property at all.
Mm.
So to say that, you know, so in front of me is Brittany's jar that she's using for water, because we use jars here. So she's got a water jar here. For me to say that this water jar has existence, well, in a way, that sentence makes sense. Am I saying that it's in the category of existing things? But I haven't told you anything about it. I haven't told you any features of the glass. All right, yeah. Features of the glass would be the shape, how clear it is, you know, how much water it has in it, etc. When you say that something exists, you haven't described it.
It would also be weird to talk about the category of non-existent things. We can't really say anything about them.
Well, actually, this makes me want to go back to Norm's, the piece of paper we had with the squares
right,
on it.
Right.
The columns that we're labeling, we are essentially labeling the categories of those columns, right? So if you want to, and we were talking about existence in that case. So whenever you say that existence is a category of something, that makes sense to me.
Right.
That's what we were doing in that thought experiment. Well, we were using existence as a category.
Yeah, but you can use any traits as categories. I don't think this argument is conclusive, by the way, because I think that you could argue that existence is a property. And I don't think it is, but I don't think that it's just smack dab obvious that it's not.
Yeah.
So, for example, Chalmer, you said, well, then technically you can't be talking about things that don't exist. Well, people do that all the time.
And we talk about magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unicorns, dragons.
Right at this moment, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people having conversations about their role-playing characters online.
Oh, yeah. Well, shoot, every other Sunday I talk about characters that don't exist.
Sure. We can talk at length about people in the Tolkien universe.
Mm-hmm. Right. People who write books. I like writing short stories. If you play a video game, will you create a character?
Right. And what some people would say about existence being a property is they would say, well, no, existence is a property, because when you say something exists, that does change your thinking of it. So, you know, earlier, if we were talking about Dr. Manhattan, mm-hmm. if I told you guys, and by the way, did you know that Dr. Manhattan exists? Well, now the conversation would change quite a bit.
Well, it exists in thought. That's not physical existence.
No, I mean exist. Like Dr. Manhattan exists. Well, now our conversation would get very different. And so a philosopher would say that, look, if existence is not a property, well, then why is it so interesting to talk about it? It seems that it talks like a property.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think that this is, that argument is not immediately ridiculous, even though I think it's wrong. So here's another way of looking at it. Bill Rowe, a kind of famous atheist in mid-60s, 70s, he talked about the difference between a magician and a magico. A magico was his word for a non-existing magician. So something that you would read about in a comic book or, you know, see a movie about. And a magician is a real existing magician. And he says that, look, non-existing things will not qualify as being a magician. So if you're talking about anything that doesn't exist, that just doesn't qualify as being a magician.
Mm-hmm.
That would only qualify as being a magico, because that's what that category means. And so that's what's going on with God. When you talk about the nature of God being the maximum of all attributes, It doesn't even matter if existence is an attribute or not. If you include existence as an attribute, then of course God has that. But when you say that, you're not saying that God exists. What you're saying is that no being would qualify as God if they didn't exist. So you're talking about the concept of something existing.
It's a chicken before the egg type of situation.
Sure. And look, I think that's right.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
It's a pre-qualifier before you even start the rest of it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think this turns into a real complaint that atheists have. If I have a conversation with a religious person and they talk about God in all these loving ways and warm, fuzzy ways, and then when I talk about whether God exists or not, what evidence do you have? And they say, well, I don't really care.
Yeah.
And I say, well, what have you been talking about this whole time?
Presumption starts the entire argument.
Well, I think there are some people that don't actually care whether God exists or not. That's a conversation they're uninterested in having. They're only interested in their conception of God, and this they have a warm, fuzzy feeling about. And as far as existence is concerned, they just hope that God exists. They don't rule on that one way or the other. They don't even really care.
Huh. As a matter of fact, that's why you sometimes can hear people describe themselves as an agnostic Christian.
That's hilarious.
Because they don't know. That.
Yeah, I've heard that. It's bizarre. That but,
huh. I've heard agnostic theism.
They hope that there's something there, but they live their life as if there's not.
Yeah,
they
which
would prefer to believe it.
I think that gets into Freud, but we'll talk about that in a future episode. But look, I think Bill Rowe got it right, that we can just concede that the concept of God includes existence. That doesn't prove that God exists. That improves what you would be talking about if he did or didn't. If you're talking about a being that doesn't exist, well, then that doesn't really qualify as God. And if you're talking about a being that exists, that qualifies as God. But you still have to go through the process of proving whether that being is actually there or not. Whether that concept is instantiated, is the way that philosophers might put it. When you talk about a concept, if that concept includes existence, okay, that's really interesting. That doesn't prove whether that concept is instantiated or not. That's the normal way. And that's what we're going to talk about next, is if there's actual evidence. So look, these guys, Kant and Bill Rowe, they I think picked apart a argument that, you know, if I'd have left this for you guys to mull over, I think you guys would have been annoyed if you decided to think about this for a while.
Super annoyed. Yeah. We're already annoyed.
Yeah. And I think that's a legit reaction. So I think we owe them a debt for thinking through this. And I think they got it right. And look, I think most Christians are going to say, yeah, that this argument is not right. And so they would. Where we're going to go with this is, if you really want to have a conversation with a Christian, you really got to talk about the faith issue.
Right.
Because, if we're going to talk about arguments for or against the existence of God, we really should talk about, well, should we even care? Do we care about the arguments or not?
Yeah.
So even though it's not really part of my standard order, I think probably what we should talk about next is faith. So
I like that.
I think that's what we should do, whether the evidence matters.
That makes sense.
It's really Norm, interesting thing to talk about.
Norm, thank you for giving me the answer to this puzzle, because it would have bothered me all day.
I would have Googled it. I would have Googled it.
The problem
you know what it makes you think of? I think I can't remember if it was Bertrand Russell's commenting on Wittgenstein, where he said, I'm reluctant to say something is right just because I can't think of something wrong with it, even though he thought there was something wrong with it.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of where I was with this, where like I feel like there's something wrong with it, but I can't figure out what.
And the argument that it feels wrong is not an argument at all. And I think that's what I was frustrated about.
Yeah, well, seriously, you guys just experience exactly what people in philosophy, beginning philosophy courses, experience. And look, the problem is, if you did Google this, you would actually find that a lot of the explanations are not really worded very well or very difficult to understand. So I did a fair amount of digging to find what I thought were the two clearest arguments against this.
Did it take you a long time whenever you were first structuring this class or learning about it yourself to arrive at that? Or were you also frustrated by it?
It took me, I didn't spend a full year on it, but it did take me a year to come up with these are the two best arguments against this. The first year I taught philosophy of religion, which would mean, twice, because one semester, half the year, I didn't do as good of a job talking about the opposition to it. So, it took me a year of kind of toying around with it every now and again to kind of get a clear conception of what was wrong with this. So, yeah. But, okay, onward. Next time we will talk, I believe, we will talk about faith, the nature of faith, what it means. And I do think this is important because, you know, if you are an atheist, you know, the new atheist movement encourages you to not shy away from talking about religion with people, not to shy away from talking about belief in, you know, for or against the existence of God and make your case. And that this is healthy for society. This is something that we should be doing.
Right.
And so I think probably a lot of people believe that in some form or another, different levels of dickishness, but, you know, believe in that. And so the one of the biggest problems that you're going to run into if you decide to engage people in their religious beliefs is people who don't care about the arguments for or against. They really don't give two shits. Their belief is based on faith, and that's the end of it. So I really think that it's probably important that we tackle what that means.
It's almost not worth arguing with those people.
Some people get very offended at different attempts to define faith.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I like to always start with people to look, we have to agree on what the meaning of a word is. And a word has to have meaning in order for it to be useful. Words have to mean something. And they can't have a meaning that is peculiar to you, because then the purpose of a word is to communicate ideas amongst ourselves.
Communication wouldn't be possible.
Right. So, you know, before we get started, we need to agree on what faith actually means. And, you know, if they resist that, then they're just not cooperating and there's nothing you can do about that. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about later is whether even engaging people in debates about the existence of God is a good idea at all. You know, or in fact, newsflash, I'm going to suggest that it's probably not. It depends on their level of sophistication or open-mindedness, but a lot of people are not open-minded, and a lot of people have not been familiar, are not familiar with these kinds of arguments. No. So probably in most cases it's not, which feels weird, because you have this, you'll have this huge arsenal, and we all do already, of arguments against what religious people believe. And so you want to bring them to bear. We're kind of like the United States, right? We feel like we're a superpower. We've got all these weapons. We need something to do with it. Well, the problem is just because you have them doesn't mean you should. And so that's a topic we'll save for another podcast as well. Right on.
Well, this is fun, Norm. Thanks for leading us through this. This was a good one.
You're welcome. Yeah. And yeah,
we need your guidance.
We've got some, we've got some movies to see.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, I made a list.
Yes.
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina
is excellent.
And then the other one that you said that Azazel is in.
Azazel?
Azazel.
Wait, yeah. You haven't seen Fallen. X-Men Days of Future Past?
No, the other one.
The Fallen.
The Fallen.
I think John Goodman's also in it. It came out circa 99 or something.
Yeah, I think that's kind of an underrated movie, actually.
The Fallen. No,
yeah. Okay. And that one's like interesting.
What?
The demon in that, he transfers via touch, physical contact, I think.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right.
You might like a movie called The Machine.
The Machine?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a British indie film about AI.
I will check it out. And there was another movie you guys mentioned for me. Oh, Dark City, that I've Dark seen City. A long time ago, but probably didn't give it a fair shake. Is that right, Dark City?
Dark City, yeah.
I love Dark City.
I mean, it is cheesy, but the cheese is kind of part of the fun.
All right. Well, yeah, Laura's away for a lot of the day, and I'm kind of trapped to my room while the house is being worked on. And by the way, if you heard any of that in the recording, it's just a...
He stopped like 20 minutes into it, so...
A little bit of a project going on in my house, but yeah, so I've got some time to check this stuff out. And, nice. You know, look, I think we're going to enjoy talking about God, even though we're frustrated with religion in general. It's an interesting topic, so I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, me too. I always enjoy talking about it.
All right. Nick, you want to take us out?
Yeah, everyone out there, please, you know, if you have a concept of it, make sure that you think about it responsibly.